84. As for shooting. Major Sheikin had been investigating the case of the broken lathe for a week and was still baffled. All he knew for sure was that this lathe, with its open graduated sheave, its manually operated rear spindle, and its dual transmission, manual or belt drive, manufactured in Russia in 1916 in the heat of the First World War, had been, on orders from Yakonov, disconnected from its motor in No. 3 laboratory for delivery to the engineering workshops. Since the two sides could not agree on how to transport it, the laboratory staff was ordered to get the lathe down to the basement corridor, where the engineers would take over, wrestle it upstairs to the yard, and across the yard to the workshops. There was a shorter way, which did not involve lowering the lathe into the basement, but this would have meant allowing Zex onto the front yard, in full view of the main road and park, which, for security reasons, could not be allowed. Of course, now that something irreparable had happened, Sheikin privately recognized that he was as much to blame as anyone. He had attached no importance to this major industrial operation, and had failed to keep a close eye on it. The mistakes of men of action are obvious enough in historical perspective. Nobody is infallible. In the event, the staff of No. 3 Laboratory, comprising one supervisor, one man, one disabled man, and one girl, could not move the lathe unaided. So, without authorization, 10 prisoners were recruited at random from various rooms. No one had even thought of noting their names, and it cost Major Sheikin 2 weeks of hard work to collate different accounts and reconstitute the full list of suspects. These 10 prisoners had actually lowered the heavy lathe from the first floor to the basement. The engineers, however, had not provided a working party. Their boss, for technical reasons of his own, was in no hurry to get his hands on the lathe, or even sent someone to check and confirm delivery. The 10 conscripted Zeks, having dragged the lathe down to the basement without supervision, dispersed. The lathe stood for several more days, blocking the hallway in the basement. Sheikin himself had bumped into it. When, at last, people from the engineering workshops came for it, they spotted a crack in the plate, made a fuss, and left the lathe where it was until they were compelled to remove it 3 days later. Sheikin's case was based on that fatal crack. It might not be the reason why the lathe was still not working, Sheikin had heard doubts expressed, but the implications of the crack were much wider than the crack itself. The crack signified that hostile forces, as yet unmasked, were at work in the Institute. It signified also that those in charge of the Institute were blindly trusting and criminally slack. If the investigation was successful, and the criminal and real motives of his crime exposed, it would be possible not only to punish one man and deter others, but to make the crack the occasion of a major political educational campaign in the collective. And, finally, Major Sheikin's professional honour demanded that he unravel this sinister tangle. But it was not easy. So much time had been lost. The prisoners who had moved the lathe would by now have made a criminal compact and agreed to vouch for one another. Not a single free worker, a horrifying oversight this, had been present. And there was only one informer among the 10 carriers, a worm-eaten character whose greatest feat to date had been to report a bedsheet cut up for dickies. He had helped to complete the list of 10 men, but had nothing else to offer. For the rest, all 10 Zeks, brazenly confident that they would escape punishment, maintained that they had carried the lathe to the basement undamaged, had not slid it downstairs on its mounting, and had not bumped it from step to step. Moreover, according to their evidence, no one had been holding that part of the lathe under the rear mandrel where the crack had developed. They were all gripping it beneath the sheave and the spindle. In pursuit of the truth, the major had drawn several diagrams of the lathe, showing where each of the carriers stood. But as the interrogations proceeded, Sheikin seemed more likely to master the turner's trade than to discover who was responsible for the crack. The only person who could be accused, if not of sabotage, of intent to carry out sabotage, was the engineer Potapov. Losing his temper after 3 hours of questioning, he had blurted out, "Look, If I'd wanted to wreck that old washtub, I'd simply have sprinkled a handful of sand in the bearings, and that would have done the trick. Why bother to smash the mounting? This statement from a hardened saboteur Shekin promptly recorded, but Potapov refused to sign it. What made this investigation so difficult was that Shekin could not resort to the usual means of getting at the truth. Solitary confinement, the punishment cell, a smack or two in the kisser, short rations, nighttime interrogations. He could not even take the elementary precaution of holding those under investigation in separate cells. They had to put in a full day's work, and so must be allowed to eat and sleep normally. Still, as early as Saturday, Shekin managed to wring out of one prisoner the admission that when they were descending the last steps and blocking the narrow doorway, Spiridon the yardman appeared, shouted, "Hold on, boys, let me give a hand," took hold of it, so becoming the 11th man, and helped to carry it to its destination. The only conclusion to be drawn from the diagram was that he had gripped the base beneath the rear mandrel. It was this valuable new thread that Shekin proposed to unravel that Monday, neglecting reports on the trial of Prince Igor received from Stooley's early in the morning. Immediately before lunch, he summoned the ginger-haired yardman, who came from work just as he was, in a donkey jacket held together by a frayed canvas belt, took off his big-eared cap and fumbled with it guiltily, the very picture of a peasant waiting on his lord to beg a patch of arable land. He was careful, too, not to step off the little rubber mat and leave footmarks on the floor. Shekin glanced disapprovingly at his wet boots, and sternly at the man himself, then let him stand there while he sat in his easy chair, silently scanning various documents. From time to time, as if shocked by the evidence of Yegorov's criminality, he shot a startled glance at this bloodthirsty beast, caged at long last. Procedures prescribed by the science of interrogation for denting a prisoner's morale. A half hour of unbroken silence went by behind Cheekin's locked door. The lunch bell rang loud and clear, reminding Spiridon of the letter he expected from home, but Shekin paid no attention to bells. He went on silently shuffling the thick folders and transferring things from one drawer to another, frowning over document after document and glancing briefly at dejected, hangdog, shame-faced Spiridon, as though astounded by what he read. The last drop of water from Spiridon's boots had finally trickled onto the mat and left them quite dry, when Shekin said, "All right, then. Come closer." Spiridon moved toward him. "Stop there. This here. What is it?" He held out a photograph of a youngster in German uniform, bareheaded. Spiridon bent over, screwed up his eyes, glanced at it, and said apologetically, "I'm a little bit blind, see, Major. Let me get a close look." Shekin gave permission. Still holding his shaggy cap in one hand, Spiridon framed the photograph with all five fingers of the other, turned it to catch the light from the window at different angles, moved it past his left eye, and scrutinized it minutely. "No," he said with a sigh of relief. "Never seen him." Shekin took the photograph back. "Yegorov," he said sadly, "denial will only make it worse for you. All right, then. Sit down." He indicated a distant chair. "We're in for a long talk, too long for you to stay on your feet." After which he fell silent and buried himself in his papers again. Spiridon backed over to the chair and sat down. At first he laid his cap on the chair next to him, but after a sideways look at its spotless soft leather, he changed his mind. Resting his cap on his knees, he sat hunched up, drooping, a picture of abject contrition. He was, in fact, thinking, "What a snake you are! What a dirty dog! When am I going to get my letter? Maybe you've got it here?" To Spiridon, who had undergone investigation twice in his time, been re-investigated once, and seen thousands of prisoners under investigation, Shekin's little game was crystal clear. But he knew that he must pretend to take it seriously.
"The fact is, we've received further information about you," Sheikin said, with a deep sigh. "It seems you got up to all sorts of mischief in Germany."
"It might not have been me, though," Spiridon said reassuringly. "Believe me, Citizen Major, us Yegorovs were like flies in Germany. I've even heard say there was a General Yegorov."
"What do you mean, not you? Of course it's you. Look here." He jabbed the file with his finger. "Spiridon Danilovich. And your date of birth."
"My date of birth?
So it isn't me," Spiridon said confidently.
"I always kidded the Germans I was 3 years older."
"All right, then."
Sheikin's face brightened, and he spoke more briskly, as if he saw no need to continue this tedious interrogation. He pushed all the documents away.
"Before I forget, you helped to carry a lathe down to the basement 10 days ago. Remember, Yegorov?"
Yes.
"So where did you run into a bit of trouble? On the stairs or down in the hallway?"
"Bit of trouble?"
Spiridon sounded surprised.
"There wasn't any fighting."
"Where did you bash the lathe?"
"God bless you, Citizen Major. Why would we be bashing a lathe? How could a lathe upset anybody?"
"Yes, well, that's just what I'm wondering.
Why did it get broken?"
"Maybe you just dropped it."
"Dropped it? We held its little hands and went over so carefully, like it was a child."
"And you, yourself, where were you holding it?"
"Me? On this side, of course."
"Which side?"
"My side."
"Did you grip it under the rear mandrel or under the spindle?"
"I wouldn't know anything about mandrels, Citizen Major. Let me just show you."
He rose, slapped his cap down on the next chair, and turned around as if lugging the lathe through the office door.
"I was bent over like this, see? Backing. And those two got stuck in the door, see?"
"Which two?"
"I don't know them from Adam. We haven't stood godfathers to each other's kids." "I shouted, 'Stop! Let me get a better grip!' And that great big what-do-you-call-it goes, 'What? What do you call it?'"
"You know what I mean,"
said Spiridon over his shoulder. He was beginning to get angry.
"The thing we were carrying, of course."
"The lathe, you mean?"
"The lathe, then. I shifted my grip."
He bent his knees and tensed his body to show how.
"One fellow squeezed in at the side, another shoved his way through, and between the three of us, we managed to keep hold of it easy enough."
He straightened up.
"In my time on the kolkhoz, we shifted heavier things than that. 6 of our women could have managed that lathe easy as pie, and carried it averse. Where's that lathe, they'd say? Let's go and lift it, just for fun."
"Do you mean it wasn't dropped?"
the Major asked menacingly.
"I'm telling you it wasn't."
"So who broke it?"
"It really did get busted."
Spiridon sounded surprised.
Well.
He had finished showing how the lathe was carried, so he sat down again and was all ears.
"Was it undamaged when they collected it?"
"I didn't see, so I can't say. Maybe it was broken before."
"And when you set it down, how was it?"
"It wasn't damaged then, I keep telling you."
"Except for the crack in the mandrel?"
"There wasn't any crack,"
Spiridon answered confidently.
"How could you see there wasn't, you wall-eyed devil? You're as good as blind, aren't you?"
"I'm blind, Citizen Major, when it comes to paper. When I'm doing my job, I can see everything. You and the other citizen officers keep dropping your cigarette butts when you walk across the yard, and I have to rake it clean. Even when there's white snow on the ground, I rake it all up. You can ask the commandant."
"So what are you saying? You put the lathe down and looked it over carefully?"
"What do you think? We'd done the job, so we stopped for a smoke, as usual. We all gave the lathe a friendly slap."
"Friendly slap? What with?"
"The flat of the hand, of course. Like this, on its side. Like you might a horse in a sweat. One of the engineers said, 'A nice little lathe, this. My granddad was a turner. He worked on one like this.'"
Sheikin sighed and reached for a clean sheet of paper.
"It looks very bad, Yegorov, your refusal to confess even now. We will have to bring charges. It's obviously you who broke the lathe. If it wasn't, you'd point to the culprit."
He spoke confidently, but inside he was no longer so sure of himself. He had been master of the situation. He had been the interrogator. The yardman had answered readily and in great detail, but the first hours of the investigation, the prolonged silence, the photographs, the raising and lowering of the voice, the lively discussion of the lathe, had been a complete waste of time. That this ginger-headed prisoner, with the permanent obliging smile and the deferentially bowed shoulders, had not yielded immediately meant he never would. When Spiridon had mentioned General Yegorov, he had already firmly concluded that this confrontation had nothing at all to do with Germany, that the photograph was a fake, that the godfather was bluffing and had summoned him precisely because of the lathe. It would have been a miracle if he had not been sent for. The other 10 had been shaken like pear trees in autumn for a whole week. After a lifetime of hoodwinking authority, Spiridon had easily held his own in this tiresome game. But so much pointless talk grated. What vexed him most was the further delay in handing over his letter. And although Shchikin's office was a nice, warm, dry place to sit in, nobody else would be doing Spiridon's work out in the yard, and it would just mount up for tomorrow. Time was going by, and the bell for the end of the break had rung long ago, when Shchikin ordered Spiridon to sign an admission of responsibility under Article 95 for making false depositions, recorded his own questions, and twisted Spiridon's answers to the best of his ability. At this point, there was a sharp tap on the door. As he showed out Yegorov, whose muddle-headedness had gotten on his nerves, Shchikin encountered the business-like reptile Siromakha, who could always give you the gist in a few words. Siromakha glided in noiselessly. The startling news he had brought and his special position among the informers put Siromakha on the same footing as the major. He closed the door behind him and, before Shchikin could take hold of the key, raised his hand in a melodramatic gesture. He was play-acting, speaking clearly but quietly, so that no one could overhear him through the door. He reported that Doronin is going around showing people his money order for 147 rubles. He's fingered Lyubimichov, Kagan, and 5 others. Doronin's lot ganged up in the yard and trapped them. Is he one of yours? Shchikin grabbed his collar and tugged at it to ease his neck. His eyes looked as though they had been squeezed out of deep holes. His thick neck was a dull red. He rushed to the telephone. His face, usually supremely complacent, was that of a madman. Siromakha arrived not at walking pace, but in a series of cat-like jumps to prevent the major from lifting the receiver. Comrade Major. As a prisoner, he ought not to say comrade, but as a friend he was obliged to. Not right away. Catch him unawares. Elementary prison wisdom. But even this he had to be reminded of. Zigzagging as though he saw a bear behind him, Siromakha backed toward the door. He did not take his eyes off the major. Shchikin took a drink of water. Can I go, Comrade Major? It was hardly a question. If I learn anything more, I'll come back this evening or tomorrow morning. Sense slowly returned to Shchikin's goggling eyes.
9 grams of lead. That's what the swine can expect,
were his first hoarse words.
I'll fix him.
Siromakha left noiselessly, as though from a sick room. He had only done his duty, as he saw it, and was in no hurry for his reward. He was not altogether sure that Shchikin had a future as a major in the Ministry of State Security. This was an exceptional event, not just at the Malfino Institute, but in the whole history of the security services. Rabbits had every right to die. They had no right to fight back. The call to the head of the vacuum laboratory came not from Shchikin directly, but through the man on duty at a desk in the hallway of the institute. Doronin was to report to Engineer Colonel Yakonov immediately. The overhead lights had been on for some time in the vacuum lab, although it was only 4 in the afternoon. It was always dark there. The head of the laboratory was absent, so it was Clara who took the call. She had just arrived for the evening shift, later than usual, had been chatting with Tamara, and had not once looked at Ruska, though Ruska's burning gaze never left her. The hand that held the receiver was still wearing a scarlet glove. She spoke with downcast eyes, while Ruska stood at his pump 3 steps away, devouring her with his gaze, imagining how that evening, when everybody else had gone to supper, he would take that head in his hands and kiss it. With Clara so close, he lost all awareness of his surroundings. She raised her eyes. No need to look for him, she sensed his presence, and said,
"Rostislav Vadimovich, Anton Nikolaevich wants to see you at once, urgently."
She could not have spoken differently with people watching and listening, but her eyes were different, substitutes, as though a dull, lifeless film had formed over them. Ruska obeyed mechanically, without wondering what this unexpected summons to the engineer colonel might mean. He could think of nothing but Clara's expression. He looked back at her from the doorway. Her eyes were following him, but she averted her gaze immediately. Unfaithful eyes. She had looked away because she was afraid. What could have happened to her? With his mind on her alone, he went up the stairs to the duty officer, his normal wariness in abeyance, unmindful of the need to prepare himself for surprise questions, for a head-on attack, as a nimble-witted prisoner should. And the orderly officer barred the way to Yakonov's office and pointed to Major Shikin's door in the depths of the dark lobby. Except for Siromaka's advice, Shikin would have called himself, and Ruska would immediately have expected the worst, alerted a dozen friends, and above all contrived to speak to Clara, find out what was wrong, and either carry away ecstatic belief in her or be released from his commitment. There, at the Godfather's door, realization came too late. Under the eyes of the Institute's orderly officer, he ought not to hesitate. He could not turn back. He must not arouse suspicion, if he was not already suspect. Ruska did, nevertheless, turn around to hurry back downstairs, but the prison duty officer, Lieutenant Zhvakun, the former executioner, summoned by telephone, was already on his way up. So Ruska went in to Shikin and took a few steps forward, bracing himself and trying to look unconcerned. Drilled by 2 years under investigation and a gambler of genius by nature, he stilled the storm within him and rapidly switched his mind to new dangers. Looking boyishly guileless and eager to please, he went in, saying,
"May I? I'm at your service, Citizen Major."
Shikin was sitting awkwardly, slumped forward against his desk, dangling one arm and swinging it like a whip. He rose to meet Daranin, and the whip arm swept upward to strike him in the face. As the other arm swung back to strike, Daranin retreated toward the door and prepared to defend himself. Blood was trickling from his mouth, and an unruly lock of fair hair had fallen over one eye. Too short to reach his face now, Shikin stood before him baring his teeth and sputtering threats.
"You dirty, rotten swine! Betray me, would you? Say goodbye to life, you Judas! We'll shoot you like a dog! Shoot you in a cellar!"
It was 2.5 years since capital punishment had been abolished in that most humane of countries. But neither the Major nor his unmasked informer cherished any illusions. What can you do with one who falls from favor, except shoot him? Ruska looked absurd, with his tousled hair and blood running down his chin from a lip swelling as he watched. Nevertheless, he straightened up and brazenly replied,
"Shooting? Now, that will need thinking about, Citizen Major. I'll see you behind the wire as well. You've been a general laughingstock for 4 months now, and you're still drawing your pay. They'll tear those epaulets off you. But as for shooting, we will have to wait and see."